Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Bruce Klinger. These days, he is a senior research fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. He is a man who comes to that role with a considerable and impressive background in the U.S. intelligence community, including long service at the Central Intelligence Agency's Korea branch and as the deputy division chief for Korea. He has written extensively about Northeast Asia and particularly North Korea, among other places, at the Daily Signal. He is frequently called to testify on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, and it is always a privilege to have him with us. Good to have you once again. Bruce, thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
Well, thanks for having me again, Frank.
We have, of course, been following with great interest developments in North Korea, some of them involving the proliferating missile capability of the North, some the ongoing evidence of its improving nuclear weapons capability, certainly its belligerency. Give us a sense, Bruce, of where you think the North Korean threat stands at the moment. How imminent is it to the continental United States in particular?
Well, it's very real, and it's growing. In the last 2 years, particularly, North Korea has really gone on a spree of missile launches. Some of them are tests for the missiles that are still in development. Others are exercising a war plan for the missiles that are already deployed. So right now, the best estimates are that South Korea and Japan are already under a nuclear threat from the Nodong medium-range missile, which people assess already have nuclear weapons. Then North Korea has had sort of breakthrough successes in two different intermediate-range missiles that can hit Guam, which is a critical node for the U.S. defense of the Pacific, including the Korean Peninsula. And then it also has a submarine-launched ballistic missile, which, when that's finally operational, will make it very difficult to track and, if necessary, target those missiles. And then it is continuing to work towards actually several different ICBM versions. And of course, we saw the launch on July 4th. So right now, the best estimate is that that missile which was flown, it was the first test of it, and it was successful to counter to the perceptions that North Korean missiles always fail. It was flown to an unusually high trajectory, so it wouldn't fly over Japan. And the best estimates are, had it been flown on a normal trajectory, could have gone at least 6,700 kilometers. That's all of Alaska. And it likely has the capability to go far further than that. So perhaps even portions of the continental U.S. And of course, the end objective would be to be able to hit the entire U.S.
Bruce, there are some who continue to express the sense that this isn't that imminent a problem because they haven't perfected the miniaturization of the nuclear weapons that would go on these missiles of longer and longer range, and or that they don't have the reentry vehicle technology down. What's your professional judgment on those two counts?
Yeah, the North Korean missile and nuclear program seem to be slow and methodical. And even when they have a failure, which, you know, any missile in development is going to fail occasionally, particularly in the beginning, they learn and they continue to plod along. So what I found really, though, over the years is it just seems to be a tendency by many to downplay the North Korean threat. There were, back in the day, denials of the North Korean plutonium weapons program, then denials of the uranium-based program, denials that North Korea was involved in building a nuclear reactor in Syria. And then now it seems by some still a downplaying of nuke or missile capabilities. But what we've seen, particularly in the last 2 years, is sort of a lot of surprise by experts of, you know, either a success by North Korea or a missile went further than expected, or given even some photographs of rocket engine tests that North Korea releases, scientists will say, oh, it's got a better engine than we expected. It's using better propellant than we estimated. And there seems to be a lot of surprises, I think, by some experts. So when people say they haven't miniaturized, well, of course, there's no evidence that they haven't. And you know, most experts, including those in the government, think that they already have a miniaturized warhead for the missiles that can range Japan and South Korea. And this test on July 4th, it may have successfully tested a reentry vehicle for an ICBM. We don't know yet.
There are some who say that the missile itself was something of a surprise to U.S. intelligence. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, the particularly the U.S. government was saying that it was a missile that we hadn't seen before. I think many of us thought it had been one of the missiles paraded this year in Pyongyang. So I think people are still hashing out sort of what missile it is and even what the designator is. But there's a bit of confusion on sorting out which missile is which. But we know they have actually several different kinds of ICBMs that they're working on. And of course, they were already having a thing which we call the Taepodong, they call the Unha, which is, they claim, a space launch vehicle. But by putting a satellite into orbit successfully twice, that's an ICBM technology, and governments and experts assess that already has the capability to range the entire continental U.S.
And on this satellite business, one of our colleagues and frequent contributors here, Dr. Peter Pry, has, as I think you know, Bruce Klinger, been talking for some time about the possibility that those satellites themselves could be used as delivery systems, if not in sort of the fractional orbital bombardment system approach that the Soviets used back in the day or had deployed back in the day, then perhaps as a platform for an electromagnetic pulse attack on the United States. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that sounds like a pretty sophisticated system that would be already in orbit. And I think the systems that South Korea put up in December 2012 and February last year, I think are probably more likely to be kind of a Sputnik-like, you know, they got it up there and put it into orbit, and that for them was a great success. Whether they have the sophistication yet to do the different systems you described, that may be beyond their capability right now, but perhaps it's something that they are working on.
Let me ask you quickly, Bruce, and we only have a couple of minutes, unfortunately, but talk a little bit about the responses to all of this. The Trump administration is reportedly putting a bit of a squeeze on the Chinese, not simply taking their word for it that they're going to help on this, but actually creating some costs to them for not putting the kind of pressure they perhaps uniquely can put on the North Korean client state there. What's your reading of what the administration is doing? And very quickly, if you can, what should it be doing that it's not?
Right. Well, there's, I think, two lanes in the road with China. One is the diplomatic side, where we're trying to, pressure, cajole, and, you know, implore them to fully implement the required UN sanctions. And certainly they've been underperforming on that. They turn a blind eye to proliferation, illicit activities on their soil. The other lane in the road would be law enforcement, and it's enforcing U.S. laws. So because the vast majority of all international transactions, financial transactions in the world are denominated in dollars, and that includes North Korean and Chinese, they must go through a U.S. bank regulated by the U.S. Treasury. So the U.S. successive administrations have pulled our punches. We have not sanctioned Chinese entities, banks, and businesses that are misusing the U.S. financial system. The second tract is enforcing U.S. law. The U.S. has actually tremendous authority and leverage over Chinese banks and businesses, because the vast majority of all international financial transactions in the world are denominated in dollars. And that means they must go through a U.S. bank regulated by the U.S. Treasury. So North Korean entities, Chinese entities that are misusing the U.S. financial system, including money laundering, we not only can, but we must, sanction them and take measures. For example, the U.S. has imposed $12 billion in fines on European banks for money laundering for Iran, and we haven't imposed a single penny in sanctions or fines on any Chinese bank. So I'm hoping when the Trump administration sanctioned the Bank of Dandong about 2 weeks ago, that's really the first of many shoes to drop.
It certainly seems long overdue, for sure. And I hope you're right that it will be a precursor to a much more intensive effort to persuade the Chinese that it is not in their interest any more than it is in ours to prop up this regime in North Korea and tolerate its increasingly threatening behavior. Nobody understands it better than you, Bruce Klinger. We're very appreciative of you taking a few minutes to talk with us about it, and look forward to doing so with you again in the meantime. Keep up the great work at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center and the Daily Signal as well. We will talk next with Kyle Scheidler about, among other things, Qatar and Mosul and how all that's sorting out. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.